Our second case is United States against Harris. Counsel for the defense.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Lieutenant Heather Cassidy, and I represent the appellant, Private First Class Harris, in this matter. Chief Judge Efron, with your permission, I'd like to request that 3 minutes of my time be reserved for rebuttal.
Please proceed.
Your Honors, appellant is entitled to meaningful relief for two Article 13 violations. The first occurred when appellant was denied necessary medical care while in pretrial confinement for almost 3 months. The second occurred when appellant was subject to excessive conditions of confinement, which were more rigorous than necessary to ensure his presence at trial. I will address each Article 13 violation in turn. First, appellant was subject to illegal pretrial punishment when he was arbitrarily denied necessary medical care by government officials who knew that appellant had a serious medical condition and knew that he had requested access to that care.
How did he request it?
Your Honor, he requested it through his Civilian Defense Counsel in a memorandum dated May 2nd, 2004.
And that's the unsigned letter?
It's electronically signed, yes, Your Honor.
And what record is there in the record that says to whom and when and how it was received?
The document itself, Your Honor, is addressed to, I believe, Brigg reviewing authorities. The Civilian Defense Counsel stated that he delivered it to trial counsel. There's no evidence in the record regarding the fact that trial counsel actually received that document. At that point, the government would be on notice that appellant had a serious injury that required this particular medical care and that appellant was requesting that care.
In the, was the serious injury reflected in the intake medical procedure at the Brigg?
Well, Your Honor, there appears to be in the record a check-in document that was taken on February 28, 2004 during a wellness assessment, and there's no indication on there that appellant had this condition. However, the Brigg had access to appellant's medical records, which documented continuous course of care, which included this a diagnostic test, which was a CT scan, and an assessment with a general surgeon on approximately a monthly basis. As the sole provider of a pretrial detainee's medical care, the government was obligated to provide at minimal care, but however, in this case, was obligated to provide the necessary medical care because this was a serious medical condition.
Is the government, is the appellant arguing that the Brigg officials were made aware of this through any means other than through the counsel unsigned, electronically transmitted letter?
There are facts on the record that indicate appellant also informally requested that this care be provided to a corpsman who visited up with him in special quarters. That evidence was never rebutted. However, this court is bound by the military judge's findings of fact unless they are clearly erroneous. And findings of fact that are clearly erroneous here are that appellant did not request, the military judge specifically found appellant did not request any medical care until July of 2004 when he found blood in his urine. However, the May 2nd document is unrebutted evidence that the government was put on notice as of that date. Now, appellant did testify that he dropped Farnell DD-510 chits, which were a means by which a prisoner could complain or raise an issue with the Brigg. However, those were not turned over, or Brigg officials did not find those in their file for appellant, so that evidence was rebutted at the trial level. Because appellant placed the government on notice as early as May 2nd, 2004, that he required necessary medical care, and because the government was obligated by its duty of care to provide him with that, and because the government failed to provide that care, this court should find that the intent to punish it existed, and an inference of that is raised by these facts. again, here the government knew about this medical condition. They had access to the medical record. They had two formal requests from Civilian Defense Counsel specifically asking that this that these needs be met, and no response whatsoever for approximately 3 months. Within the Article 13 framework, this is an arbitrary response. There was no legitimate governmental purpose served by denying appellant access to this medical care. And this court has certainly granted discretion to confinement facilities and then not second-guess those security determinations with respect to how to run the facility. However, in this case, there's no legitimate governmental objective served by denying appellant this medical care, not security reason, management, operational.
If we accepted the military judge's findings of fact, in other words, he didn't inform them until July, are you suggesting that because the brig had had access to his medical records, that they had an affirmative duty to go over them and pick out anything that appeared in there and ask him about it?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. Appellant would argue that yes, the confinement facility or the government in this case had an affirmative duty to make themselves aware of medical issues with their pretrial detainees.
Isn't that the purpose of the in-brief, medical in-brief, in part?
Yes, Your Honor, it would be.
Was the appellant not aware of his own condition?
Well, Your Honor, there was no testimony and no findings of fact in the record regarding whether appellant informed during the wellness check and the individual who conducted that. There's certainly no notation in the documents that were filled out at that time.
And what in the medical record can you reflects that or would have put the government on notice of a duty to continue to send him over?
But, Your Honor, the medical record itself is contains a document which, first of all, it contains the records of every visit appellant had with a general surgeon following a CT scan, the results of those particular CT scans, and then the assessment by the surgeon. Documents in the medical record indicate that on almost a monthly basis, I believe except for January of 2004, appellant was attending Camp Lejeune Hospital to receive this CT scan and was then meeting with a general surgeon. In addition, Civilian Defense Counsel put all of this information in his May 2nd request and his June 29 request for a medical appointment. And so, at minimum, the government was on notice that these necessities existed, should have inquired further, although appellant's position is that they should have provided the care requested.
You're saying at least as of May 2nd and June 29th?
Yes, as of May 2nd, the government knew. It is more egregious, the denial is more egregious in light of the fact that appellant again requested this care on June 29th and was deafened by silence. There was no response provided whatsoever.
Counsel, Article 13 doesn't provide a general authority for military courts to correct deficiencies in the confinement facilities, but rather is tied to the question of whether there's been pretrial punishment in regard to this particular issue. Assuming that the May 2nd letter provided adequate notice to the government as to his condition, where is the punishment in this case?
Well, Your Honor, Article 13 is rooted in due process concerns. And so, as the United States Supreme Court stated in Bell v. Wolfish, a pretrial detainee can't be subject to punishment before his guilt has been adjudicated in accordance with due process of law. The punishment here is that the government, who had an obligation to provide this appellant with this care, for no reason whatsoever was denying him that care. And as a result, was treating him as if he were being punished already. And beyond that, was endangering his health, because the government didn't...
Is the denial of medical care an authorized punishment under the code?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, can you rephrase the question?
Never mind.
He could be, whether he was in pretrial or post-trial, denial of medical treatment, let's just presume, was inappropriate, and failure to respond to defense counsel's letters is inappropriate. But the question here in the pretrial context is, where is the punishment? How did he specifically suffer as a result of inaction in response to the May 2nd letter?
Appellant would argue that this court can certainly infer that there was he suffered in that there was mental anguish involved in knowing that he had this medical condition that required care and that he had been receiving care for and that he was unable to obtain because he was in pretrial detention. Now, this court has...
Before you leave that, then, in your view, then there is nothing in the record to demonstrate that he suffered any physical detriment as a result. Okay.
And you're arguing mental anguish, but this is someone who's quite happy to send chits around. Are there any chits that are reflective of this anguish?
No, Your Honor. And to be fair, every request chit appellant submitted was not a complaint, as we interpret that phrase. They were required to submit chits to do anything. So if you review those request chits, appellant was simply asking to make telephone calls to his stepfather or receive mail.
But it is reflective of the fact that he knew how to communicate within the Briggs system.
Yes, Your Honor. And again, when he testified that he made informal complaints regarding this need for medical care, it was not until those were not responded to that it appears he went to a civilian defense counsel and asked him to attempt to communicate to obtain the necessary care because no one was responding to his request.
What was the necessary medical care that he didn't get?
Specifically, Your Honor, to receive a diagnostic test, a CT scan, which would view internally what was going on to ensure that the laceration from the ruptured spleen was decreasing and not increasing, and then an assessment by the general surgeon to interpret that result to determine whether or not he was healing. Because at one point, one doctor he had visited with in the record indicated that he had advised him he may require surgery. So constant monitoring was necessary, and that specifically involved a CT scan and an assessment by a surgeon.
So necessary in a theoretical sense, not necessary because it caused him any harm or injury?
Perhaps not necessary in the urgent emergency sense, Your Honor, but necessary as far as
his mental state?
Well, Your Honor, it was conveyed to him that this was a care plan arranged by a surgeon he was seeing. So it was necessary in that a doctor with...
Is there anything that would have prevented counsel or this appellant from having an affidavit or getting testimony from a doctor so they were not in a position where we were relying on appellant or his counsel's assessment of his medical necessities? So they could have called Dr. Butler and or gotten an affidavit from him.
Appellant would.
There's no, like, procedural bar to that. And the government did not prevent appellant from doing that.
Appellant does not know of any, Your Honor.
The injury took place in May of 2003, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
Right. And so he had been under a continuous course of treatment from May of 2003. He was would it be accurate to say that he was well on the road to healing by the time he went in pretrial confinement?
Based on the record, yes, Your Honor. However, he had not been placed in a full duty status, and
now, I understand that.
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm just asking, based on what's in the record, he was well on the road to healing by the time he went in pretrial confinement.
It appeared to be so, Your Honor.
Thank you.
There is also testimony in the record from Lieutenant Commander Laurent, who was the caseworker at Camp Lejeune Hospital, who stated that this course of care was something that was arranged with the surgeon and was based on the surgeon who was seeing him's recommendation. So this wasn't a course of care appellant came up with offhand. This was something that had been discussed and had been, to use the term, diagnosed, but at least required and complied with for the past 6 months. As a policy matter, this court cannot permit the government to engage in such arbitrary denials of medical care, because where appellant, there is no evidence here he suffered any physical harm, that may not be the case with the next service member. And in this case, where the detainee is forced to rely upon confinement officials to provide medical care, and if they don't, he will not receive it, to allow the government to replace its discretion with the discretion of a medical professional is inappropriate and is a dangerous policy. Accordingly, this arbitrary denial of necessary medical care for almost 3 months constitutes illegal pretrial punishment, and appellant requests this court grant meaningful relief. Turning to the second Article 13 violation in this case, appellant was subject to conditions of confinement that were more rigorous than necessary to ensure his presence at trial. The record reflects that while in pretrial confinement, appellant was subject to 21 hours a day in his cell. He was only permitted to leave while in restraints. He was forced to take all meals in his cell. And there was no evidence whatsoever in the record that indicated any of these restraints were necessary. He was not a security threat. He was not a flight risk.
But aren't those conditions the typical conditions for an individual in the maximum confinement category?
Yes, Your Honor.
And didn't the military judge award one-for-one credit for that classification?
Your Honor, the lower court awarded credit for what? The lower court's opinion addressed the classification procedure as an arbitrary policy. There was evidence that the CORMA system, which was used at the Camp Lejeune Brig, only considered the seriousness of the charge and did not conduct an individualized assessment. And, Your Honor, I see that my time has expired.
Please take your time to answer Judge Erdman's question.
But wasn't the thrust of that, but the because of that procedure, the confinement classification may have been improper, and the award was one-for-one credit. And if that is the case, then why are we now again looking at the consequence of an improper classification?
Yes, Your Honor, if I may. Appellant would argue that these are two different violations, and in the United States versus McCarthy, for example, this court addressed the maximum classification, max custody classification, as potentially two separate violations. The lower court, the classification process, which did not involve an individualized assessment, is punishment, whereas here, appellant is arguing that the conditions themselves, which were never discussed by the lower court and included being subject to confinement with roaches and rats and in serious heat, were not addressed by the lower court. And because the conditions were more onerous than necessary, the appellant should also be entitled to meaningful relief because it amounted to punishment as well. In conclusion, the government punished appellant in this case in two respects, and accordingly, appellant requests this court modify appellant's sentence by sentence by the bad conduct discharge.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Mr. Chief Judge, may it please the court. My name is Lieutenant Timothy Delgado, and I, along with Commander Paul LeBlanc, represent the government. Now, to begin, the appellant states that, as a policy matter, this court can't allow the government to deny medical care even where there's no physical suffering. Here's a countervailing policy matter. Adopting the policy position put forward by appellant would result in a flood of baseless statements in hopes that appellants or confinees will receive a windfall down the line on appeal. And that's even where they're not suffering from actual medical harm, but simply mental anguish, as described here. Now, there are two issues squarely before the court. The first is whether the lower court should have awarded additional credit for the conditions of confinement that appellant encountered at the Camp Lejeune Brig. Second, did the lower court fail to provide meaningful sentence relief when it awarded appellant 186 days of confinement credit after he had already been released from the brig? The answer to both questions is no. Appellant comes here with a heavy burden of showing that the military judge's findings of fact were clearly erroneous, and additionally of showing by preponderance of the evidence that he's entitled to additional sentence credit. The burden is on appellant. Findings of fact in this case were supported by ample testimony in the record indicating that there was no intent to punish, that appellant was in fact provided with adequate and ample medical care when requested.
And what is your response to the appellant's argument that the military judge concluded that TFC Harris did not personally complain about the need for any particular treatment until July? What about the May 2nd and June 29th, whatever?
Judge Baker, as appellant pointed out, there was nothing in the record beyond the fact that Civilian Defense Counsel at trial stated that he constructively served these on the trial counsel in the case. But there's no record that the brig officials were aware of these or that they failed to act upon them in light of these submissions.
So it's the government's position that the record does not reflect that trial counsel was in fact served with these, received these?
The government has not contested that these were served. To answer your question, Your Honor, yes, the government will concede that these were served constructively upon the trial counsel or upon brig officials through the trial counsel. In light of that, however,
So how does that make the statement that he did not personally complain until July if you're conceding that the prosecutor and the brig officials had these memos as of May 2nd? Why isn't that... are you relying on the fact that he didn't complain, he only had his lawful representative complain?
Yes, Your Honor. That is our position. And what we're looking at here is the fact that...
So the lawyer does not, in fact, speak for the client?
The lawyer is a paid advocate who will complain on any basis that the appellant asks him to. The lawyer did that in this case.
But that's not my question. You're saying he's a hired gun. Whether he's a hired gun or not doesn't make it true that the complaint didn't occur until July. Hired gun or not, you just conceded that the government received a complaint on behalf of this guy on May 2nd.
Your Honor, there's nothing in the record that would suggest that these were not actually served upon the trial counsel. Defense counsel, again, stated that he provided them to the trial counsel. But other than that, there's nothing in the record to indicate one way or the other whether these statements were served upon the trial counsel or brig officials.
Now I'm confused.
I guess
so
I'm
confused. Which position are you going to adopt here?
Arguing that the record, insofar as it shows anything, it shows that Civilian Defense Counsel stated that he served these upon the trial counsel, Your Honor.
So the government is not conceding.
I think that would be a correct statement.
So here we have a situation in which, was this trial counsel some other trial counsel that participated in the case?
No, Your Honor.
And trial counsel said nothing about this? Did the trial counsel put any affidavit in the record or any information to suggest that trial counsel did not receive this information?
No, Mr. Chief Justice, there's nothing in the record to indicate.
So what inference should we draw from that?
Anything, because I don't want to move down a negligence line of inquiry, the government will concede that these were served upon the trial counsel.
Okay, so the trial counsel receives it. And I understand the government's argument that the failure to complain personally has some bearing as to whether there was actual physical suffering in the case. But for purposes of notice, is the government taking the position that when a service member tells his or her defense counsel that they have a medical need, and that defense counsel provides the trial counsel with information that is insufficient to put the government on notice as to the medical need?
That's not our contention at all.
Okay.
When, obviously, defense counsel speaks for appellant, and when defense counsel puts the government on notice, that is adequate. As this court has held in McCarthy and reiterated repeatedly thereafter, the fact that an appellant has complained is not in and of itself a per se reason to support a finding of penalty or punishment. Appellants can often be very vocal about their conditions of confinement, and the fact that they have complained does not establish a violation alone. So in that regard, yes, appellant complained constructively through his defense counsel twice. But what we're looking at here is whether the military judge's findings of fact were clearly erroneous. And you have these two complaints from the civilian defense attorney and these statements that the appellant says that, or he claims to have dropped DD-510 shits during one succinct statement at page 23 of the record. And that the military judge weighed against evidence that, in fact, there were repeated shits that were dropped, 18 of them to be precise, were dropped by the appellant. And in none of them did he mention medical care.
Let's focus on the communications from the attorney, though, okay? Because the judge concluded that the government was not put on notice until July by anyone that there might be an issue there. And then once they were put on notice, his concerns formally to the attention of the authorities, appropriate action was taken to address his medical needs. If the government is conceding that the trial counsel or the government received on May 2nd something, why is it correct or not clearly erroneous to say they didn't receive any notice till July? May 2nd is not July. Now, you may be able to say, fair, okay, nonetheless, blah. But if, in fact, the government was put on notice on May 2nd, what appropriate action was taken to address his medical needs, if any, on May 2nd?
There would have been none at that time, Your Honor. And again, appellant brought the condition of the blood in his urine to the light of the government in July. He was seen by the chief hospital corpsman on the
scene. So is it the government's position that maybe there's no duty on the part of the government to respond to such inquiries from representatives?
No, obviously, Your Honor. If there were a valid medical issue that was presented to the government, yes, they would have.
And where is it reflected that someone in the government determined on May 2nd that there was no valid medical condition that required treatment?
That is not
valid. Now, the government should be concerned about that, not only from Article 13, but as a matter of good government.
Absolutely
right. So where in the record is there any reflection that the government responded to this by documenting that there was no medical need, et cetera?
That will not be found in the record, Your Honor. What will be found is the fact that appellant was visited 3 to 4 times each day by medical personnel and brig personnel at the brig, at which time he complained not once.
And that occurred after May 2nd.
That's correct, Your Honor. And before May 2nd. It occurred from the time that he was placed in pretrial confinement until sentencing. Assuming that the military judge's finding of the medical care in July was clearly erroneous, the rest of the military judge's findings, in fact, were supported amply by the record, and they were adopted by the lower court. And specifically, the lower court found that the judge's findings, in fact, with regard to intent to punish, as well as the finding that adequate medical care was provided when requested, were supported by the record.
Didn't the judge's finding of fact, in fact, say that he did not personally complain until July?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
It does.
Okay. And are simply silent as to any prior complaint through counsel.
That's correct, Judge Stuckey. And even assuming that this...
But are you relying on the technical legal argument that his counsel can't speak for him?
No, Your Honor, that's not our position at all. But just looking back at the facts as the military judge had them, in case this court chooses to review de novo, the facts were as follows. Appellant said that he was scheduled to be returned to full duty at the time he was placed in pretrial confinement. That's on page 32 of the record. He says that he experienced no pain or problems with his spleen until he speculated that it might be related to blood in his urine. That's on page 33. He hasn't done any heavy lifting while on the brig. Nothing the doctor didn't clear him to do. And that's on page 37. Testimony that the judge heard also included testimony from Chief Warrant Officer 2 Hirschman, the programs officer and active brig officer, who discussed the classification system in the brig, but also discussed the fact that he had reviewed the 510 chits submitted by appellant, and none of them discusses an injured spleen. Chief Warrant Officer Hirschman discussed the applicable Second Ave instructions as well as military handbooks for the administration of brigs. Chief Warrant Officer Laird, the brig officer, testified about the fact that there was no infestation of vermin, that the brig was sprayed on a monthly.
Counsel, is your argument with respect to the letters of counsel from May and June that irrespective of those letters, that the bottom line is that this appellant was not denied necessary medical care?
That's correct, Your Honor. And when appellant states that as a policy matter, the government should not disregard necessary medical claims, it's absolutely the government's position. What we have here was a fictitious medical claim, or one that was not, in fact, necessary. In looking at this case under the Eighth Amendment analysis that's been provided by other courts, we're supposed to, the court is invited to look into whether or not there was a deliberate indifference to a necessary medical condition. In this case, there was no medical condition. And if we look after the fact, for 1 year after appellant had suffered this ruptured spleen, the record indicates that the injury itself had resolved, that there was no recurring injury. Appellant not once complained of pain or injury while he was in the brig. So the fact that two letters were served by appellant's defense counsel is not dispositive of the issue. It shows that he complained. But again, according to this court's precedents, the fact that a complaint was lodged is not itself indicative of a finding of pretrial punishment. I'd like to move on to the issue of what constitutes meaningful sentence relief and whether or not that was afforded in this case. And the government position is that, yes, the lower court did provide meaningful sentence relief when it awarded 186 days of day-for-day confinement credit. The term meaningful sentence relief needs to be construed in light of the statutorily available remedies that are present before the court. And appellant has come before this court proposing, in their first brief, an all-or-nothing remedy of disapproval of the bad conduct discharge. Appellant, it appears, changed course in their reply brief and shows out a cornucopia of possibilities, requesting none and just asking that the court do some sort of equity or find meaningful relief somewhere. But appellant has specified no relief requested upon which we can respond. Our response does include the fact that total forfeitures were adjudged in this case, and by operation of Article 58B, appellant would not be able to recoup forfeitures. This case is different. It's fundamentally different from United States versus Pfluger, relied upon by appellant, in that the punitive discharge had already been remitted at the time that the lower court looked and reviewed the case, and so it was off the table. It would be, in effect, as if the lower court were trying to disapprove a sentence that had never been adjudged at all. In this case, 12 months of confinement time was on the table. The lower court reviewed that and found that 6 months of day-for-day credit would be awarded for this 305 violation.
And what did the appellant in this case actually receive as a result of that sentence relief?
He received day-for-day credit, Your Honor.
Right. Did he actually not serve time as a result of that?
He had concluded his time adjudged at the time the lower court came out with this decision.
So he had already served his time. Did he get any money?
There's nothing in the record to indicate that he has received money.
Go ahead.
Sorry. What he may have, Your Honor, is a valid claim with the Court of Federal Claims or the Navy Claims Office. So in the sense that he has meaningful sentence relief for any time that he effectively served in a non-pay status or a pay that is due, appellant has a valid claim that he can take up with the Court of Federal Claims or the Navy Claims Office. And he'll do that under...
Under what theory would he be paying?
It would be, Your Honor, it would be 28 U.S.C. 1491A1, which is the Tucker Act.
I understand, but where is he due any pay? Under what theory is he due pay?
Your Honor, he would be due pay as follows. Appellant was awarded 186 days of Allen credit, and then effectively 30 days of 305K credit. Appellant received 186 days credit from the lower court. Because of the fact that he was adjudged 1 year in confinement, he should have, in retrospect, effectively been released on the day of sentencing. So from the time, from the day of sentencing on the 31st of August until the day that he was released, he's entitled to that amount of forfeited pay because he was in what amounted to a non-pay status.
Well, this may be naive, but rather than making him go through the Tucker Act to the claims court, why doesn't the government just ensure that he is allowed to recoup this money?
He would be able to, Your Honor. I can't stand up here and tell you how specifically he will be reimbursed. I can represent that there is an avenue through which he can seek reimbursement. But the issue here is the fact that appellant has not requested that form of relief. He's not requested back pay or specified some kind of date with which this court should calculate whatever back pay is due. Instead, appellant has proposed an all-or-nothing remedy of a disapproval of the bad conduct discharge. And I would invite the court's attention to the last page of the appellant's reply brief. In it, appellant states, finally, in the interest of judicial economy and equity, this court should not remand this case to the lower court, but should instead affect meaningful relief in this case at this stage. Appellant's not looking for some kind of confinement credit or pay. Appellant's looking for a disapproval of bad conduct discharge. They don't want this going back for a sentence reassessment, and they've stated that explicitly in their penultimate line to the reply brief.
Where in your brief does it state that the 186 days is meaningful relief because the accused would be entitled to a remedy for those 186 days?
Your Honor, it does not say that explicitly in our brief.
Well, you're representing that to the court.
There are two positions, two facets to that argument, in that one, there are no steps. The lower court provided, within the field of statutorily available remedies, the lower court provided all relief that was available. And derivative of that, appellant will have a claim, may have a claim with the Court of Federal Claims or the Navy Claims Office that he can seek. But that is an administrative remedy, and it's not properly before this court. What's before this court is the fact that appellant has requested a disapproval of the bad conduct discharge, or if you can't have that, please find some equity. That's what appellant's reply brief has kind of changed course and is looking for at this point.
What are we to make of all the cases in which the government comes to our court and says no meaningful relief can be given because the person has already served their time in confinement?
Well, again, Your Honor, Mr. Chief Judge, the court is obviously informed by the dictates of the rules for court martial, the MREs, as well as the UCMJ. Article 58B and 58A make very clear they define several contours about what kind of relief and what situations that relief is available. Appellant, it's not clear from the record that appellant has any dependents. In order to provide what would amount to the relief that appellant is requesting, this court would effectively have to either disapprove the bad conduct discharge or
I'm not talking about appellant's request. I'm talking about the government's position. As I understand the government's position today is that confinement already served nonetheless doesn't preclude a finding of meaningful relief because an individual can put in a claim.
That's correct,
for that time, so that in cases where the government is faced with a discharge, it's not an all or nothing situation, that giving credit against confinement is appropriate even if the confinement has been served.
That is correct, Your Honor. And very briefly, appellant has not met his burden of showing that the military judge's findings of fact were clearly erroneous, and he's not met his burden of coming before this court and showing by preponderance of evidence that he's entitled to additional Article 13 credit. With regard to meaningful sentence relief, Your Honor, if I may.
Please take your time to finish your thought.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Judge. The lower court did provide appellant meaningful sentence relief in that the credit that was awarded will provide the basis for a valid claim. But insofar as appellant has requested a disapproval of his bad conduct discharge, that's simply disproportionate to any minor harm suffered here. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have a rebuttal?
Just briefly, appellant would like to just briefly address the issue of meaningful relief. In this case, the court can craft some form of meaningful relief that is not disproportionate to the harm suffered. Specifically, to clarify appellant's request, appellant has requested that this court set aside the bad conduct discharge. Now, appellant believes this is proportionate to the harm suffered given the egregious pretrial punishment appellant suffered over 3.5 years ago. However, appellant has also suggested or requested alternate means which would also provide appellant with meaningful relief. The point is that awarding pretrial confinement credit will not place appellant in a better position than he would have been in had this error not been discovered, which is how this court approached the issue of meaningful relief in United States versus Fugger. And for example, in United States versus Suzuki, this court found that awarding additional pretrial confinement credit would not result in a sentence that greater than would have been the result if the prejudicial error had not occurred. And so this court went back and modified another portion of the sentence and set aside the forfeitures. This court can set aside the forfeitures in this case and all of the confinement, which would, if this error had been found at the trial level, would not have been served, given all of the confinement credit given by the military judge, the lower court, and then this court. So that would not be a windfall to appellant. And as a result, the automatic forfeitures provision would trigger such that appellant would be entitled to the return of those automatic forfeitures.
What about the government's argument that the credit that was awarded provided a basis for a future claim?
Unfortunately, Your Honor, appellant's not as familiar with the Tucker Act as this court may be and certainly as the government is. However, appellant would argue that he should not have to go through those steps when this court can certainly craft meaningful relief here. And beyond that, the lower court awarded relief that was not meaningful. Appellant is here alleging two different and new Article 13 violations for which no relief has been granted and respectfully request that for these violations, this court craft a remedy. I see that I'm out of time, and that concludes my argument, unless there are further questions.
Thank you, counsel. We thank both counsel for your presentation today. The case is submitted, and the court will stand in recess until 9 a.m. tomorrow morning.
The court stands in recess until 9 a.m. tomorrow.